This is the 12 Songs of Christmas. I'm Alex Rawls, and today I'm talking to Eli Paperboy Reed about Soul Christmas. Reed has a new album, Hits and Misses, the singles on Yep Rock Records. And we talk about that too, since it includes some cool stray tracks from throughout his career, some original and some covers. You can see why a soul singer like Reed would take on Lattimore's Let's Straighten It Out, but he also figures out how to give an R&B treatment to Motorhead and Steely Dan, and that's less expected. That also provides us a bridge into Christmas music, because one of the things we talk about with artists is how they take familiar songs and not only make them make sense for them, but how they give the versions a reason to live. Reed's covers on the album and on Christmas music show the same creativity and passion, so there's a connection. A few notes on the interview. Number one, my family has a puppy, and occasionally she felt the need to express herself while Eli and I were talking. I tried to mute my mic when she got barky, but you may hear Asha in this episode and in future episodes, hopefully not too often. If you don't know Reed, he's made a career of singing classic R&B and soul, and he'll tell you a short version of his story during the episode. Eli and I also talked about two tracks that are not generally available, and this is note number two. A version of The Emotions' What Do the Lonely Do at Christmas, an awesome sad Christmas track, and Party Hard for Christmas, a track of his I discovered on SoundCloud. Eli will talk about it as if we all know what's going on, because I asked if he had an MP3 copy of Party Hard for Christmas. Evidently, based on our conversation, he doesn't consider the version that's in the world now to be finished, so he and his people didn't pass me a copy. I'll put a link to both those tracks in the show notes. Eli first got attention when he released Come and Get It in 2010 on Capitol Records. Here's the title track. And I'll be back on the other side shortly with Eli Paperboy Reed on the 12 Songs of Christmas. So we're talking as you're about to release Hits and Misses, the singles, yep. And it'll be out by the time people hear this. And it includes original songs as well as covers of Dylan and Merle Haggard, Lattimore. By the way, Lattimore knocks me out.
Thanks,
man. I always wonder the same thing, though, when I see a collection of sort of odds and ends tracks like this. How does an artist end up with an album's worth of stray tracks?
Well, it's sort of, that's the big question, I suppose, is, you know, when you make a record, you kind of always end up going in, either you have too much or you go in afterwards and you cut some extra stuff just for something and I've made, you know, eight records now. So between the eight records, there was always a stray single or a track for, I don't know, a TV show or something that didn't get picked up. And it was just, I had all these things that I kind of thought were great. And I had, you know, some of them had been on 45s that I sold on the road or used for something, this and that. And I just, you know, was talking to the label about what was coming up, and Yep Rock, my record label, has they've gone all in and on the Eli Paperboy Reed business and own or license a lot of kind of my stray music. The stuff that isn't owned by major labels is all under one umbrella, which for me is great because it makes my life so much easier when it comes to releasing stuff or finding homes for things. And I said, what do you think about this idea? And they were all about it. Because I think also a lot of these songs came out before the streaming era really took off. So you have music that never really was introduced to the broader population, which just wasn't available the same way. So that's sort of where we ended up, you know, coming up with this concept.
One track on it, I Came to Play, appears in the Disney animated series Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. How did that come about?
So it really, quite naturally, there's a guy named Steve Loader, who's the showrunner for that show and is a big fan of mine. And we had had a couple of meetings just to talk about any projects we might want to work on together. And, you know, he's just a fan and has become a, kind of a friend. So I just was like, hey, man, here's a pile of demos that you might like. So I just sent him a bunch of stuff and he honed in on that and said, can we get this finished for Moon Girl? And that was right. Literally, I took a trip to Los Angeles in February of 2020 and we kind of made that call and we wanted to do that. And then obviously the world shut down, but animation continued to happen because animation kind of could happen in a more, you know, spread out sort of way. So they needed the song to be finished. So I had to find a way to get it finished kind of in the midst of the original COVID lockdowns in New York. So I was able to convince my good buddy and collaborator, Vince Chiarito, who has a great studio in Brooklyn. And we worked together in as socially distanced a manner as we possibly could and finished the record and got it turned in on their timeline. And then it, you know, got used in the show and it was really, really cool. And that was sort of the end of it. And when this was happening, we decided to include it in this compilation, just because, again, it was a song that I felt like deserved another opportunity.
Do you write or record demos with the potential of licensing in mind? Like, do you do work just sort of on the maybe that this might find a home?
I mean, although if writing songs is, you know, I think that I will write songs for a project, but I will also write songs as they happen. I mean, I think ignoring inspiration, you ignore inspiration at your downfall, right? And that's, you know, I think especially as, you know, when things happen, when ideas come to me, I try my best to at least write them down and get, you know, get the idea on paper or, you know, a little voice memo or something like that. And then oftentimes that's what I'll do. And I'll have something that's kind of a scrap an unfinished fragment. And when it comes time to finish a project, that's when I will go back in and do it. And that's sort of what happened with that is, you know, my friend at Disney who heard that demo and I just was basically, you know, okay, now it's time to go and finish it.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because, you know, one of the issues we're dealing with in New Orleans is that New Orleans is such a live music community. And when people talk about how to try to in some way deal with the, how hard financially life is as a musician, people start talking about licensing and mailbox money. And right. So I'm always conscious when I see things like this is like, are other musicians in other cities sort of out there kind of trolling for mailbox money?
I mean, it's been a help to me a lot over the years, you know, having licensing and syncs and stuff like that has been a big part of my career. You know, it's funny. I feel like when you try, that's when it doesn't happen. So that's sort of the sad reality of it. I think, you know, I've done some stuff that's been directly for film and TV and some stuff that's been picked up. I mean, it's sort of all over the map. I mean, the music that I make naturally, I think is thankfully lends itself to that. I haven't, you know, I haven't had to try all that hard, you know, which is, I mean, knock on wood. But that's sort of, I mean, it's become a much more crowded marketplace, I think, unfortunately. You know, or fortunately or unfortunately, that's the reality we're in, is that that's how a lot of musicians and songwriters specifically can make money these days. It's not an easy marketplace out there.
Yeah. Some people can pull the line, don't know a thing about winning time. Tonight ain't made for messing around. I'm gonna teach you to shake the ground. There's no You were a kid in Massachusetts. How and when did you realize you had a voice for soul?
I mean, my father is a big record collector and music lover, and we had a lot of, you know, just amazing records around the house, country music and soul and R&B and gospel music. And I sort of gravitated to soul music. I mean, I loved all of it, you know, but I don't know. I'm just like, I found it and it grabbed me, you know? And then I sort of didn't think about, you know, why it wouldn't make sense, I suppose. And, you know, I just singing along to Jackie Wilson and just said, okay, if Jackie could do it, then I'll do it too. You know, and that was it. I mean, I was, you know, 15, 16 years old and that was, you know, where I got started and I never really stopped.
Well, but the question I come back to is a whole lot of people love soul and R&B. And if they sing it, it doesn't sound like you singing it. you have a voice that's you know, you have a good soul voice, a good R&B voice.
Sure.
Was there a moment when you realized not only do I like this, but I can do this? This is my thing.
Yeah, so I think that I was in high school and I was singing a lot I was in the high school jazz band and playing saxophone kind of nominally. But my teacher was very supportive of me and she knew like how deep I was into the music. And basically the story is that I would graduate high school 2001, 2002. And after 9/11, I went and I sang America the Beautiful over the PA system, the loudspeaker. That was kind of the first time I had ever thought that I wanted to sing something in public and it felt appropriate and people were appreciative and thought it was good, I guess. And so later on that year, they asked me to sing it again at the Martin Luther King Day assembly. We had a school-wide assembly.
Wow.
And I said, well, instead of singing America the Beautiful, why don't I sing A Change is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke, which seemed to be more appropriate for that event. So I got my crew from the jazz band, my like friends, and kind of put this arrangement together. And I sang A Change is Gonna Come for the whole school. And people sort of lost their minds. And I think that was sort of the beginning of my career as a singer.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, on Hits and Misses, you cut two tracks in Muscle Shoals at Fame with members of the house band, David Hood, Jimmy Johnson, and Spooner Oldham. Tell me about that experience.
Sure, it was amazing. So I got to be quite friendly with Rodney Hall, who is the son of Rick Hall, who's the founder and producer at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And Rodney at the time was doing a companion soundtrack to the Muscle Shoals documentary that had come out, whatever that was. And he asked me, among other people, to come down and record it at Fame to do some songs for this, to kind of redo some Fame classics. And I was actually the first person he called, which is really quite an honor. So I suggested doing Steal Away, which was the first big hit that Fame had in 62. And then we were talking and I said, well, if I'm going to come down, we might as well cut some other stuff too. You know, because we're here. And so I got to cut that and I suggested to do, I Don't Know What the World Is Coming To, which was a hit for the Violinaires gospel group, the Violinaires. And I thought those guys could really sink their teeth into it. And they certainly did. It was just an amazing experience to just be live on the floor, playing with those guys, singing live, you know, directing traffic. You know, when people set up and play, it sounds like that place, you know. So that was, you know, it was very special, very special time. Incredible people and just an amazing experience.
Did you get a new appreciation for the songs that were recorded there by either being in that space or working with those musicians?
I think it gave me a more of an understanding of how they worked I was certainly an appreciator already. But just to see how those guys, you know, it was like for them, especially this was their job. You know, they clocked in at whatever it was and set up and somebody maybe had a lead sheet, you know, or didn't, and they learned the tunes and then they cut them, you know, and that was it. You know, whether it was Etta James or some whoever that came in that day, a hit or a not hit, they worked the same way and they spent the same time doing it. And you can see, like, there are time cards, you know, like those guys, this was their job, you know? So that's just an interesting way to think. I mean, that was how it was a factory, you know? I mean, granted, they were all amazing, but they were amazing because they did it all day, every day.
Right.
I'd like to see you
on Hits and Misses. You know, part of the fun is like you remaking Steely Dan and remaking Motorhead as R&B tracks. Can you walk me through the process of working up your version of Ace of Spades?
I mean, it was pretty straightforward. You know, the riff itself is very iconic, so obviously you need that. And, you know, you want to recast it in a way that makes sense, so it's not a heavy guitar riff, and that, you know, move it to the horns and that's easy. And the song is like already the form of it is felt to me like it could be a soul record. I was inspired by the Ralph Soul Jackson version of Sunshine of Your Love, actually.
Okay.
It's a kind of obscure cover, a Muscle Shoals actually cover of Cream. And I was like, okay, this is the feel that I think we could go for. And you know, the tempo didn't change all that much. I don't know. It felt very natural. We just sort of picked it up and started playing, you know, it just took the time and cut it in half instead of, it was, you know, it just cut the time in half. And then that was it. We didn't even change the key.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. Yeah. I mean, I think part of the beauty of it, and part of the reason I think it works so well, is it does sound like when you do it, it sounds like, why hasn't somebody done this before? It seemed natural.
That's the idea, right? You want to do a good job. You want to make it something that makes sense. And if it wasn't, I probably wouldn't put it out. You know, I like, you know, and you also want to if you're going to cover something, unless you're going to do it something, I'm going to do it either really perfectly or really different. Those are your choices, right? You know, and I don't really see it doing it otherwise. You know, what's the point?
Sure.
Otherwise, it's just a throwaway.
Talked about your dad as being a record collector. Did he collect Christmas music?
Well, we're Jewish, so not really. No, he did not.
Yeah. So Christmas music was not a meaningful part of your growing up.
Let's see. I remember we played. My dad would have an office Christmas party every year, and we played it a lot. Actually, me and my dad would play together. We played Please Come Home for Christmas and stuff like that. I remember doing that. Yeah, we did some of that.
What was your relationship to Christmas music growing up?
You know, I didn't think about it too much. It's funny because my wife was not raised Jewish. And like her instinct is, you know, after Thanksgiving is to immediately put on Christmas music. And I find it kind of off-putting. But I think there's great R&B Christmas records. I think I have a, you know, whole long playlist of them that I've made, you know, so I can put that on instead. I think it's amazing how much of it there is.
Yeah. You, now you recorded in 2018, you did on Roll on the reissue of Roll With Me. You put a version of William Bell's Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday which is on the Stax Soul Christmas album. Why did you decide to do that one?
It's just something we had been doing in our set. Same like you said, it's something that I felt fit and I love the record and it's just, I never thought about that as a holiday song in a funny way. It was just like something that fit, you know, for me. It's a good record nonetheless. You know, and I did a Christmas single, when was that? A couple of years ago when we did the kind of R&B version of Last Christmas, and I had a Christmas song of my own that I wrote called Merry Christmas to Me. Yeah. That we put out as a single.
Yeah. I'm going to get to those two. I was going to walk us there.
You're on your way. Sorry.
Yes. Okay.
Right. I apologize.
One of the reasons I asked about at this point about every day will be like a holiday was because it is sort of on the line between Christmas song, not Christmas song. Like if it hadn't have been released on Soul Christmas, there's almost nothing else in the song that gives it a Christmas marker.
No.
And so I would imagine, since you were talking about growing up Jewish, I would imagine that would be a sort of a seasonal song that would be seasonal / not seasonal. And it would be one that would be fairly easy to find your place.
There are lots of Christmas songs that are sort of non-denominational too. You know, I feel like it's become something that is not necessarily about, you know, whatever, religiosity.
Every day will be like a holiday. When my baby come home. Now she's been gone.
I was actually going to ask about that because, you know, this comes up on the podcast a fair amount, as you'd expect, because, you know, the relationship of Jews to Christmas is a really complicated one. And, you know, so many of the classics were written by Jewish songwriters.
That's true. Irving Berlin.
Yeah. And now, I have, you know, friends here, and I'm sure around the country, who, while Jewish, celebrate some version of Christmas. So I'm always fascinated by how people, what connections people make, how they connect, what parts they connect.
Right.
Does your family celebrate Christmas?
We celebrated when I was growing up, we had a tree and stuff like that. I wouldn't say that we celebrated Christmas. It was sort of like we did, you know, something.
Yes.
we had a tree, we had presents, you know, that was sort of it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's sort of the same with my family now, with my kids, that we have a tree, we have presents, but we don't go to church or anything. And I mean, and you know, my family is still Jewish, but we still celebrate. Like I don't feel like having presents for Hanukkah makes any sense.
Right.
So, and that's okay. You know, it's okay with me to have Christmas, you know, with my kids and have that be a thing that they can look forward to. I'm okay with that.
You know, one of the things I find interesting in this, and I guess part of where this is going, is also like you have done a number of gospel songs, and I know you've talked extensively about your interest in gospel. How do you make those two pieces fit together?
I mean, I feel that gospel music can be experienced as an art form, you know, regardless of your religious, you know, affiliation. In my opinion, it's you know, as important or more, you know, as a foundational element of all American music, especially vocal music. You know, I think that, you know, with especially music that came out of the Holiness Church and, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, I find it to be grossly overlooked in general. You know, so I think from an artistic standpoint, you can't not appreciate it if you want to think about what's important in, you know, American vernacular music. I think that the faith that's exhibited in gospel music is something to be, you know, relished and savored as a listener, and something that's important regardless if you believe in the particular message that's espoused. I never found it to be a conflict.
Sure.
Really.
I tell you, I mean, I'm interested in this in part because it's a thing I have to deal with every year. We have Jazz Fest here in New Orleans.
Sure.
And it has a gospel tent, and
yeah,
it is for many people, it is the only time they will hear gospel all year.
Yeah.
And I used to have a friend who said, I only believe two weekends a year, that the, you know, while they're hearing, you know, their passion is so intense and so palpable,
sure,
that for at least the time you're sitting there, you buy in, or at least you buy into their passion. And
right. Yeah. I mean, I just don't, I think it's unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate that gospel music can't, you know, I mean, part of what I tried to do with producing the Harlem Gospel Travelers and songs for that group is to find a way to cross that divide. And it's not an easy one to cross still, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I always found it fascinating. And there's a moment where I kind of sort of backed away from trying to write much about it, even write comments, because there was a point when I remember I did start talking to some of the musicians, and I realized that, I mean, at the time I was editing the local Alt Weekly, and I realized,
yeah,
that all of the, you know, irony and the interest in kind of the multiplicity of messages and, you know, signifiers that comes out of pop music and rock music was not the way they thought about their music. And that to a great degree, many of the musicians I talked to, they really thought about it in terms of, does it win souls or not? That they were thinking very much about,
sure,
how clearly it communicated their message. And I found that started to make me really kind of a little antsy as a writer to have other people starting to treat it either ironically or sort of aestheticize it in a way that the people who made it didn't.
I think that's a hard, you know, I think that's a difficult choice to make as a performer more than anything. And that's why, you know, if you're a performer in gospel music and you go out of church settings, that's what you often encounter in terms of listeners. And it's up to you as a performer to make the choice of whether you feel okay with that or not, you know? And that's, you know, there's lots of great gospel groups that will never perform outside of the church.
Sure.
You know, or programs, you know. Look up. Look up.
When the world starts to get you down and you can't seem to raise your head,
change gears for a moment. I was looking on YouTube and I found a video of you performing The Emotions, What Do the Lonely Do at Christmas, which is another Stax release.
One of my favorites, yeah.
Did you ever record it?
No. Just that.
Oh, really? It's a beautiful version. Why haven't you done more with it?
I don't know. Never thought about it. Just like something to do for fun.
Oh, okay.
Our own Gospel Travelers do it, and I want to get them to record it, actually. They do it, but they do it better than me.
why that song, and B, why do a video of it for YouTube?
I like it. I don't know. It's like, that's the name of the game these days is content, I suppose. And at the time, I just was, you know, messing around playing it. I thought it sounded good. I mean, that's, you know, it's crazy. You know, you could just record something and it's out there, you know. But like in terms of making a record of it, I didn't feel that I could add all that much necessarily. You know, I like doing it, but I don't know if I could add all that much, you know, and make a real recording of it, you know.
Tis the season to be jolly, but how can I be when I have nobody? The Yuletide Carol doesn't make it better, knowing that we won't be together. A silent night.
In general, not just about Christmas, but any time, does rearranging a song and adapting it to your to what you do, does that give you any kind of insight into a song or a different understanding of a song?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that the more you spend time with something, like listening to it, you know, in the, you know, to learn, listening to something to learn it is different than listening to it casually, for sure. And listening to it with an eye towards reworking it is sort of an even more in-depth listening process. I mean, I think you have to internalize something fairly completely before you can rework it. You know, when I made this album of Merle Haggard songs, I spent a lot of time listening to those original recordings because I didn't want to lose the essence of what they were all about when I was, you know, even though some of the reworkings are quite radical, you know, I wanted to make sure the song still, you know, was there.
Right. Yeah. I've always thought that must be fascinating as a musician to, in a sense, at least for a moment, you kind of have to walk in someone else's shoes to understand the song, to figure out how to change it. And so totally. I feel like that there's a moment where you're having to go through and kind of understand why the musician made the choices they made the first time, so you can understand why, you know, how your choices relate to those.
Absolutely. And so maybe some of those choices aren't your favorite choices, you know, but those are the choices that were made. Yeah. And you have to figure out if, you know, at least to some degree, why and you know, what you like and maybe what you don't like about a record or a song.
Did you what was something you took away from, or you understood better about Merle Haggard after working on an album about him?
I mean, I think that his songwriting is so sparse and so effective with such, it's very minimal. I would almost venture to call Merle Haggard a minimalist in his songwriting, because he does so much with so few words. And I thought that was really, you know, I mean, part of that is why I thought the songs would translate so well to soul music, because so much of soul music is about the emotion of the performer rather than the words themselves, you know, so you can kind of imbue those words with your own sense of self. And I think that was, you know, what Merle did so spectacularly.
Now, a couple of years ago, in 2020, you released a cover of Wham's Last Christmas.
I did indeed.
So to start with, let's follow that thought. What appreciation or what did you understand about the song better after doing it?
Well, I think you listen to it. I mean, obviously the production is so of the era. But when you listen to the song itself, the chord changes and the construction of the song is very, you know, early 60s kind of Phil Spector. You know, it's a doo-wop-y chord progression. The melody is very in line with, you know, something like the, you know, Chantels or something like that. So when I spent a minute listening to it, I was like, oh, this is easy. This makes perfect sense to take in this kind of opposite direction. Also make it into a shuffle. Oh, there he is.
Yeah.
Make it into a shuffle rather than, you know, kind of the more 80s, you know, straight beat that they have. And, you know, you have the melody is so pronounced and strong that it lends itself very well to the horn section. It's just like, it's a great song. It's a great song, you know? And you know, great songs lend themselves to being reinterpreted in all sorts of different kinds of ways. And that was easy. It took me all of 15 minutes.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart. The very next day, you gave it away. This year, to save me from tears, I'll give it to someone special. Once bitten and twice shy, I kept my distance, but you still catch my eye.
You know, one thing interesting about that song is, I'm now blanking, but Dick James Publishing tried to sue because they claimed that it was too close to something else. I'm blanking what it was too close to. And the legend, I don't know, and I haven't gone back to double check this, but the legend is that essentially that lawsuit was nipped in the bud when a musicologist came and pointed out that that melody and those changes had, there were about another 100 out songs that used them.
Yeah.
And that essentially, that part of the genius of George Michael in that song was that his pop instincts were just bulletproof. And even if he was borrowing in a way that it was, you know, that he had made something unassailable, even at the same time, while borrowing from everybody that in from the from girl groups and from R&B to British pop. And
I mean, the key with stuff like that is what they call prior art. That's the musicology term, prior art. You know, if something had already done it before, or if, I mean, then like something like that, those are chord changes and melodies that are now part of the lexicon, right? You can't, nobody owns them, you know? So that was, and it's obvious, and the great songwriters use those sorts of, you know, progressions and melodies to their, to create their own versions of things that are already embedded in the brains of all the listeners, basically.
Have you had to deal with that at all? You know, as I think as somebody who works in the field of making R&B and soul that reminds you of R&B and soul of days past, I would wonder if there have been times where someone said, you got too close to my song.
There was one song on the album, Come and Get It, which is called Tell Me What I Want to Hear. And that was I was on a major label at the time. So they have a review process. Indies don't really do that sort of thing. They don't have that, but at the majors they do, because they don't want to get sued. And they felt that that song, or the melody of that song, was a little close to Everything Is Beautiful by Ray Stevens, which I was like, I don't think so, but, you know, go do your process. And they did and agreed with me that it was enough, different enough that we didn't have to worry. But it was just interesting to you know, have the process, you know, in place. I'm sure they had to deal with it all the time.
Yeah. One of the things I find interesting in what you do is, you know, you have the ability as somebody who knows, you know, the history of R&B and its different scenes, different styles. And I wonder, when you're doing a song and you know, you kind of have it in mind, you hear it as kind of as a Stax thing or a Fame thing, do you feel an obligation to follow it through the way that Stax band would have followed it through, or a way that a Fame or a or do you feel the liberty to kind of mix and match up a New Orleans rhythm section with a Memphis horns with whatever?
Sure. I mean, I just try to, for me, I just try to do what I feel is in the service of the song in the best way, or the service of the arrangement. You know, and sometimes it becomes, you know, a specific thing, but more often than not, it's a combination of all the things that I love. I mean, so much of it is all just mixed up in my head at this point. You know, there's so much music that I've internalized, you know, so I don't think that, you know, I mean, when we were doing the Merle record, you know, me and my engineer that we were making the record with, I mean, we thought a lot about mixing strategies and, you know, there's a lot of that record that has a Fame kind of element to it in terms of where we put the drums, you know, in terms of stereo spread and things like that, if you want to get into the nitty gritty of it. But also that was sort of just because we felt that it made the most sense for a record like that. I don't think that it was something that we were trying deliberately to ape at that point. No.
So you released Last Christmas in the Christmas of 2020. So did you record it during the pandemic?
No. We actually, geez, when did we record that? It was, it's a good question. No, it was right before we did the first sessions for the Merle Haggard record and recorded those songs at the same time. It was like winter 2019, 2020, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking, interested because the B-side is an original song, Merry yep. Christmas to Me. And in it, you have the lines, you know, I tell myself next year will be better. I know it has to
sure.
be. And in Christmas 2020, that felt right on time.
Yeah. It's funny. That's a song that was written a long time ago that we had just been sitting on forever. Me and my old friend and collaborator, Ryan Spraker, who used to tour with me playing guitar and now lives in Los Angeles. We wrote that together when we were on the road in Portugal, of all places. It was the middle of the summer. And just had this idea and finished the song. And that's just, it's been sitting in my back pocket. And then the idea came to record Last Christmas. I forget where that came from too. It was maybe from the label, but when I was doing it, I was record the other, make another side and do this Christmas song that I had kicking around forever.
Did the idea came to you, or did you have like, can I write a Christmas song? How did it work?
I mean, I think he might have had the idea, the concept, and I like, you know, the idea of a sad, like a, you know, sad Christmas song is always, you know, it makes sense to me. I like, and it's, you know, it's not about, again, it's not obviously not a religious song. It's a, you know, soul ballad.
Sure.
So it just happens to be about Christmas.
Right.
This time last year, we had a pretty, pretty Christmas tree. But now, all I see is emptiness where those presents used to be. So I tell myself, next year will be better. I know it has to be. I'll just stand here and look.
With these experiences, do you have thoughts about doing Christmas music again? Is it, or are you done with this chapter?
Well, I have this other song that I think that you're aware of called Party Hard for Christmas. That I guess was, I didn't even know it was available. It was something that I'd had forever that we did a few years ago. And when you brought it up with Lely, I was like, is that out somewhere? And I didn't know. And I guess it was. But now I have the session files and I'm gonna mix it and make a real version. I think we might put it out not for this year, but for next year. I was like, wow, this is good. I had completely forgotten about it.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I like, there are great Christmas records that I love. The Huey Piano Smith Christmas record is one of my favorite Christmas records of all time. The whole album is amazing. So in terms of like whether I could do a whole Christmas record, I think the answer is you never know.
Merry Christmas. Christmas, shoot me. Merry Christmas,
Thanks to Eli Paperboy Reed for the time and the talk. Eli's new album, Hits and Misses, is out now. You can find more of his music, including his last Christmas digital single, on his Bandcamp page. If you like what you hear, tell your friends. If you already have, make some more friends and tell them too. I really enjoy this conversation and the shows we've done this season and would love for more people to hear them. Let's wrap it up today with one more song from Eli Paperboy Reed. We talked briefly during the episode about his version of Steely Dan's Do It Again on his new Hits and Misses. So let's go there to finish today. Talk to you next week.
They drag.